Good evening. Step right up and check it out. It's another episode of The Last Knock featuring myself, Dr. Johnny, Num Caligari, and joining me tonight, he doesn't talk too much, but, you know, he'll come to his senses sooner or later and start walking stiffly across the landscape. Who is that in the box?
Mr. Somnambula. I've no
idea. I think it's Somnambuli, Bill.
So, oh, I'm multiple? I'm more than one? Dude, I'm like the Thing. Yeah.
That's like Michael Keaton and Multiplicity, anyway.
He gets.
Yeah, so who are you?
Cesare, whatever the hell. No, I'm Billy Crash, whatever. Cesare Crash, Crash Cesare. Well, let's get on with it.
And that's our show, ladies and gentlemen.
That was
Thank
it.
You.
We already. I already destroyed the whole damn thing. Beautiful.
Be sure to tip your waitress. And tonight we are discussing Robert Vina's 1920 film, The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, which obviously is celebrating its 100th anniversary this year. And it's obviously often referred to as one of the most influential horror films ever made, in part because of its position in history. But, you know, I think it's also a really good film in its own right. I rewatched it last night after maybe 15 years, and I found myself really taken with it. I still found it effective. Maybe we can start, Billy, with where did we first encounter this movie? Like, when did you first see it? Because I take it you've seen it more than once.
Well, I feel bad because I was preparing for The Cabinet of Dr. Caligula. I thought it was... I just couldn't resist.
I could imagine Malcolm McDowell in a remake, maybe, with some porn inserts. Sure, yeah, why not?
Yeah, hello, and he says hi, and he's got, like, his forearm all lathered up. But anyway,
Bob Guccione presents The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari.
But anyway, you know, it was funny. I avoided this for a long time, but then I went to... I had this, like, massive, crazy binge thing where I watched as many surviving horror movie silent films from the silent era that I could. Mm-hmm. And, of course, you know, you have to go to The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. And it was a really enjoyable experience for me because Conrad, you know, he's my favorite silent era actor. He just had this amazing look and feel to him, but he did something that a lot of early performers in film didn't do, and they were all stage performers. They were all actors on the stage, so they would be very exaggerated with their movements and such, because the people in the gallery, in the background, in the balcony could, you know, see what was going on. Mm-hmm. But he knew that the audience was the camera right in front of his face, and he played to it really, really well, and he looked awesome, very cool. And so he looked emo. I mean, he was like emo before emo even existed. It's like he's like this emo goth kid, you know, and it's like and the sets were amazing. I think the sets only cost $800 at the time. They were painted cardboard. It's part of the German Expressionism, mm-hmm. which was that generation's way of looking at the bourgeois and, you know, being extravagant in the way that they presented themselves in certain manners. Mm-hmm. And so it has all of that, and it's very, very cool, very profound film. And So when I watched it, and I watched along with some of the others, it was easy to see why this was such a standout over The Golem and all of these other movies, except for maybe, you know, I'm going to look real quick because I don't want to destroy this, but Student of Prague is fantastic too from that era. But this one just had a really solid story, even though it was apparently commercialized with a tacked on beginning and ending to make it more commercial.
Oh, right.
You know, hey, it's just fantasy, you know, so people wouldn't take it literally that, you know, hey, our country sucks or something like that. Our country's crazy. Our leaders are crazy, which is part of that German Expressionism. And I think that's why that changed dramatically when they did that David Lee Fisher did such an incredible job in 2005 when he made The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, also silent, also black and white,
With Doug Jones.
with Doug Jones, Judson Pierce, Morgan and such, Lauren Burkle. And it was such a fantastic movie. They used green screen, and it was really, really awesome. And it captured the true essence of the original film. And I actually enjoyed it a little bit more than the original film.
Oh wow. Yeah, 'cause you know what? That's again, that's one that's been stuck in my Netflix queue for like years,
Oh,
literally.
dude, you have to watch it, man. It's.
I'm gonna bump it up now because you recommend. I wasn't sure if you'd seen it or not, but
Yeah, I gave it
yeah.
4 stars. I was so impressed with it. It really blew me away.
Excellent. I will fast track that. Right now, Lake Mungo is at the top of my
Oh
queue.
my
You'll be pleased to
God!
hear, Bill.
Gee, are you kidding? Paul J. Williams will be pleased to hear. No, so when I saw it, I saw it at home, saw it on a big screen, and it was very powerful. It was really potent. I was swept away by it for the most part. How about you, Johnny?
Yeah, I think the first time I saw it was probably like, I think like I said, 15 years ago. I picked up a copy of it at a CD warehouse, may they rest in peace. But it was like a Alpha Video DVD. So Alpha Video does not put out very good editions of old movies, but they put out old movies. So this was like a truncated version of Caligari. I think it was like only 50 minutes or something like that, and the actual film is 75. So I have no idea what was cut out. The inner titles were very awkward, like digitally imposed kind of crap that takes you out of it. And I don't know if there were any color tints at all to it. So the first experience was not a good one when I watched it. And watching it last night, I'd picked up since the one of the Kino restorations on DVD. I think it's probably from the mid 2000s, but it played very well. The inner titles were very stylish. The color tints were very cool. I like that sort of thing. And I think, I was writing down what the color tints were because part of me is like, Bill will probably know what the meaning of this is
Holy crap.
because he knows his colors. Yeah, it was just a much better. I was watching it at like at 7 o'clock, and it was still light out, and the movie was still getting to me at certain points. So, and I had an interesting conversation with my girlfriend, who you know,
Yes, I
and
do.
yeah, and I told her we were going to be talking about this tonight, and she brought up Nosferatu, which came out 2 years later, and I'm like, and she was like, I can understand its place in history, but there's certain stuff that I just look at and I kind of laugh at, and I'm kind of like, I honestly do too, because the thing where he's carrying the coffin around the town square and it's supposed to be night, but it's like obviously noon,
Yeah, that day for night shooting wasn't solid back then at all.
no, because the lighting, the lighting wasn't what it should have been. And so I think something that I think gives Caligari an edge, even though it was earlier than Nosferatu, is that I think it was all shot in interiors, and that way they could manipulate the sense of night or dark, whatever, a lot easier than when you're using like real life, actual real world settings. So I think that was a thing that worked to its advantage, in creating a better atmosphere, I think, definitely.
Yeah, definitely. I agree. And I just thought it was so cool. They had such great contrast in there. It's like, okay, we can't do color, but man, we could do great contrast between light and dark, and it just presented. It was such a great presentation. It's cool. It's a cool movie to watch. And my gosh, I mean, what Hans got, what, $200 for the script or something like that back then, and you're like, it's like, holy crap, man.
Yeah, I mean that's
Hans
1990.
Janowitz,
Yeah, $19, $20. Yeah.
Yeah, and but I don't know if you knew this, and this is what there's so many stories around it. Like I have to, there's probably books on this that I would have to get, but apparently the writer Janowitz claims to have gotten the idea, and this is right off IMDb, to be sincere, for the film when he was at a carnival one day. He saw a strange man lurking in the shadows. The next day he heard that a girl was brutally murdered there. He went to the funeral and he saw the same man lurking around. He had no proof that the strange man was the murderer, but he fleshed the whole idea out into his film. And as soon as I read that, I'm like, what if the strange man was like, oh, there's that other guy again? You know, like, did he have something to do with it? You know, but, you know, I just played at a Paris theater for 7 years. You know, it was well received. It was banned in some places, you know, for the longest time. It had censorship certificates placed upon it. You know, in March of 1920, from the German government, you know, it's just like crazy.
I
Just.
think I think we've made some progress since then.
I don't
You
know.
know,
There were
but
still some things against it from the German government and the Finnish government in 1995 and 1993 as well. Censorship.
that's amazing.
It's
Yeah.
disgusting. That's what that is. But,
Well, in some ways, I think, you know, that the movie still has an effect, and it's still like it's still kind of rubbing a raw nerve, whatever that nerve may be. So, I
yes.
mean, that's kind of cool at the same time. Yeah.
Absolutely. Can't argue that point.
But yeah, Bill, I'm kind of with you. I think it's interesting because the film plays with like notions of metaphor and notions of psych, you know, uses kind of that abstract set design with all those jagged triangular angles going on.
It's beautiful. I love it so much.
Well, it really is. And there's a scene early on in the film where the town clerk he's the first person who dies. There's this,
Right.
he's murdered, and the cops are in his room, and there's this window in the background that's shaped just like a dagger blade, but it's also pointing right in the direction of the guy's bed
Yup.
where he was found stabbed. And I was like, that's really clever. You know,
Yeah.
everything is like a meta everything is kind of like this metaphor for violence or for things being skew or off kilter psychologically, kind of.
Yeah, the symbolic elements in there are just plentiful. It's such a cool film in regard to that. It's almost like it's not like, hey, the audience is stupid. It's more like, hey, what are cool things that you can see in here, you know? Follow the somnambulist. Where do you go, you know? And it's like so I just really enjoyed what they did and how they presented the story. It was fun and cool and creepy all at the same time, you know?
Yeah, and I mean, since this is a 100-year-old movie, we can I don't have a problem with us going into spoiler territory.
Sure, go ahead.
But you know, what did you think, Bill, about the elliptical kind of structure of the film, which I'd totally forgotten most of this movie since the last time I'd watched it, and I was like, oh, this is what's happening, and that I wasn't picking up on so much the first time I saw it. But you know, it starts off with two guys on a bench, and there's a
Yep.
woman walking around like she is sleepwalking,
Yes.
and the guy's like, oh, that's my fiance.
I know.
And I was like, wait a second, there's something. But I didn't see it coming. But I was like, that is no, there's something wrong here.
Yeah.
right from the start, even though it's presented in this like. It's this idyllic scene of two guys on a bench in a glen somewhere, basically.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, depending on who you talk to, you know, people say that, you know, whatchamacallit, the director shot the introduction and the closing scene after the fact because he didn't want, you know, he didn't want the film to be like an overt condemnation of the German authority at the time. But then you have Fritz Lang, supposedly, who said, hey, I suggested that introductory scene, you know, when after, you know, he first read the script. And I'm like, yeah, but why? And why didn't you have an end to it? So it's like, because it's really wrapped up nicely. And when you get to the end, you know, depending, you know, I want to see the film without that intro and extra. I don't want to be bothered by that and just see how it lays out.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of didn't mind it, and I didn't know about that little detail that you mentioned, Bill, about it being changed or added or whatever. But I kind of did like how the ending kind of you think it's over, and then it pulls back a bit and goes into something else, and it's like oh, it's like that Eureka kind of moment, which I kind of liked it honestly. I thought it worked. It was just kind of interesting to see that distortion, take place, because you've been following this one character throughout the film, and then who you think he is, Francis, you think he's a hero, but then it's like, well, maybe he's not. It's
And we've seen stuff like that, but before in movie, not before, but since in movies, like oh my gosh, the one with Michael Douglas where Falling Down, was that it?
The game.
No, Falling Down, where he was the guy who was really pissed off, and then and you're rooting for
Well,
him the whole movie, and then by the end you're like, oh my gosh, he's really a piece of garbage.
it was like Das Boot. You mentioned Das Boot all the time, kind of as an example.
Well, that's but I mean in regard to like, oh my gosh, this is the character I love and trust and admire for so long, and now it's like, oh my God, they're not what I thought they were.
Oh,
And
yeah.
I just had a and this is why Martin Scorsese had that warning on Taxi Driver when it appeared on television, about worshiping people, and
Yeah.
because he was so upset when he was in a theater watching Taxi Driver and everybody went and cheered when Robert De Niro came in with the mohawk and the sunglasses, and he's like, "No, you shouldn't be doing
Right.
that."
Well, there's even the story of how Kubrick would try to keep A Clockwork Orange from playing in theaters. Like, I guess this was after its initial run, because there would be youths who would go out dressed up like Alex and company
Oh
doing
yeah.
crimes, in the UK, apparently.
Oh, I could definitely see that happening.
Yeah, so I kind of get that. The film I was thinking about, actually, and I don't know what you think about this, but it's a movie I like a lot, which is having its 10th anniversary this year, is Scorsese's Shutter Island.
Oh, I love that movie. That was
Oh, okay. Great.
one of the best endings ever in movie history.
Oh, and I love the well,
The
you know the
lines, oh my God.
yeah, like the very last line Leonardo
Oh.
DiCaprio says was actually, that's not in the book. They added that for the movie, but it's perfect.
Perfect. Oh, it's phenomenal. It's
But
phenomenal.
I was like thinking, this is almost Caligari is like a, it's an insane asylum figures into the plot, and Shutter Island takes place on an isolated in an isolated insane asylum, and you have a main character who could very well see Leonardo DiCaprio kind of as a corollary to, once you kind of get everything revealed to you in that movie. So I could
Gotcha.
definitely, it's Scorsese is such a student of cinema that I wouldn't be surprised if he was pulling stuff aesthetically or in the performances or whatever from Caligari, just as an example, for something like Shutter Island, because the two are so thematically similar, I think. But yeah, that was like the big one I was thinking about.
Yeah, no, I get you. I get you, and I know you mentioned Das Boot, which is a phenomenal film. And if people haven't seen it, it's a war film, one of the best war films ever made, where you have a bunch of German sailors, submariners, in their U-boat, and they're not Nazi party people. They're just German, submariners, and it's like, well, we're fighting for a country, and that's it. And it's like Hitler, fuck him, crap like that, which is great. And these guys are just trying to get home, and you're rooting for them like mad, and they get home. And as soon as they get out of the submarine, they're being strafed by British gunfire, and you're like, no, oh my gosh, these poor guys. And then you're like, wait, I'm rooting for the enemy. Which is, it's beautiful, and it just showed, like, hey, humanity, and it's, and it was great in that regard. And that's why
Yeah.
I'll never forget that film, because of, it taught me a major lesson when I was, young about perception and We don't know anybody else's story until we've, you know, if they're out, if they're overt in the nasty things that they do, that's one thing. But if they're not, you know, before we start screaming and yelling, maybe we should ask why.
Well, and that's a really good point, Bill, because I think, like, as one of the themes go with, like, Caligari, it is one of perception, and it's a very psychologically it's fixated on psychology. You know, it's
Oh,
like
yeah.
the insane asylum, the phenomenon of somnambulism. You know, what is it, and kind of the mystery of it is figures into the plot. And what you can do with, what can you do with, like, psychiatry, and what are the boundaries of that, to use it for your own ends, or do you use it for good? Like, the eternal question, like, and which ties into mad science, which is also explored in this movie, because, you can see an influence on James Whale's Frankenstein, which came 11 years later. It just, from the sets, which, when I had to watch that movie in a film class, I was like thinking, yeah, these sets are like, they're much higher budgeted versions of, like, these German expressionist sets that you're seeing in Caligari. There's still those, like, tight, jagged angles. Things are a bit off, things are a bit skewed. To a certain extent,
Abstract.
very abstract. And you think back to this time and think, man, there was such passion in the creating of this stuff. And now I think some of that is a little bit lost now. Because you look at the, I just like when I watched that movie a couple years back, I'm like, was just taken aback by the craftsmanship of it all, like how it looked, and how the fact that someone had to build all this shit, and someone had to light it a certain way to bring it off, and it still looks great today.
Agreed. And this
But
is, oh, go
go ahead. No,
ahead.
you go ahead. Go ahead.
Well, this is why I always saw links between the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari and Lars von Trier's Dogville.
Oh, yeah, good. Yeah, please.
One of the great things about Dogville is, you know, it's supposed to be taking place in this town, but it's a stage. And what it is it's our town on steroids. And it's, you know, our town was always filmed, always performed on stage with just nothing, you know, and you had to really zero in on the characters and what they were doing, and you weren't, you didn't have to worry about set design, you didn't have to worry about being distracted in any way. And and it's great because it leads to an element of exposure, and you have that exposure of the characters here because it's almost like, you know, right from the beginning, it's like I'm in a fantasy world. So like once you get it and once you see it, and I think people, most people are drawn to the characters and what they're doing and how they're interacting. And that's why I think a lot of, like, if I were writing a paper on a film, I would have to watch it frame by frame. What am I missing? What have I missed? You know, like, what did, you know, and it'd take a long damn time to write that paper. But, you know, just to see what they had hidden. It's funny that you mentioned a set of, Frankenstein, because that set was like, holy crap, that set was outrageous. And it was amazing. Sometimes it's actually amazing, sometimes it isn't, but some of the special effects in horror films have been like really strong from the very beginning, with the innovative techniques that people would use and such. Like if you watch the beginning to Faust from the silent era, it's amazing. It's one of my favorite silent era horror films, but it just had this amazing, tremendous, frightening look to it that some movies today just can't capture. But the set decoration was by Herman Varm, which was really wonderful, and the cinematography was by Willie Hamester, and they just, like, you know, together with the director and the actors, they just created something really, really fantastic.
Yeah, no, I totally agree, Bill. I think on one hand, and I wanted to talk to you a little bit more about this, like, whereas, watching something like Nosferatu, when Murnau kind of, like, speeds up the camera movements or speeds up the character movements, it doesn't work for me, because he's trying, the story is too grounded in kind of this photorealism, I would say.
Right.
that I feel like it kind of obstructs what he's trying to do. Whereas with this film, since it's kind of this weird alternate universe almost, it is a reality, but the way things look, it's obviously it's more like the reality of a dream than kind of a waking reality. And that's why I kind of like I feel like so much of it is pulled off better by Vina in this film, because he kind of builds this, he literally kind of builds this insular world that's its own, very much its own thing.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And to that end, Bill, that's the point I was getting at, was how did you feel about the kind of the exaggerated costumes, the exaggerated facial hair, the exaggerated mannerisms of some of the supporting characters? Did you think that kind of worked within this world? Like when they capture the quote unquote murderer and he's all gruff and he looks like a pirate without a patch kind of thing. And they film him in this condemnatory close up, just to show you how gruff and quote unquote
Right.
evil he is. Or when all the cops are just like pointing fingers at him really fast, kind of like how did stuff like that go over for you?
Well, it's funny that you mentioned Nosferatu because I really didn't care for that. I didn't have, I fell asleep during it the first time I watched it. And this is where this movie ruined vampires. It ruined the vampire mythology, not Hollywood, but German filmmaking. It's like, yeah, the sun will come out, even though he was in the sun several occasions. The sun will come out, it'll burn him to a crisp, he's done. In the real vampiric lore and myth, the sun doesn't kill a vampire. So I was disappointed in like certain things that they did and the way it looked, and I was like, this is corny in many ways, even though the makeup for the character was great. However, in Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, because they presented this as a crazy people in a crazy world with crazy everything, and it's almost like in your head, twisted and bonkers, I didn't mind any of that because it fit in within the atmosphere that they created. So I thought all of that, all the exaggerations, were fine, were okay. Conrad, though, the lead actor, phenomenal because he just was so aware of his presence, and he's also the star of The Man Who Laughs, which gave
Which
rise to
is
the Joker.
great, yeah.
Yeah, it really is, which gave rise to the Joker in the Batman lore. No, it was fine with all of that because it was a crazy world, and it was a it's it they presented it where it's like this is unreal, so that's why sometimes I don't mind the beginning and the ending, that bookended stuff, even though I hear obviously the writers were pissed off, but it's like, hey man, but it works. They made it work. They made it work within the tone that they had established. So again, it's like they established rules and they had things that worked well within those rules. And I look at, I know we disagree on this one and it's fine. Stanley Kubrick's The Shining, where he's like, these are crazy people going to a hotel that's crazy because nothing matches up. There's windows, there's stairs to nowhere, doors to nowhere, windows where they shouldn't be, and the maze entrance changes three times. It's all crazy. They're crazy. And it's almost like he took a page from what was
Cabinet of Dr.
done with this
Caligari.
production. Yeah. It's like, okay, if everybody's going to be crazy, then make everything crazy.
Bill, the more you talk about The Shining in that context, the more I'm like, God damn it, I gotta watch that fucking movie again. Cause I might actually appreciate it if I can get it within some sort of context where it works. So maybe that's how I have to look at it next time I try to watch it. So
Well, I'm glad. Thank you. I appreciate that. And I do hope you enjoy it more, if not fall in love with it. But, you just brought up the perfect word, context. And anytime we watch a film, I know we're going to bring our own life experiences to it and all, and that's fantastic. But we do have to look at it within the context of how it was made.
Oh
Like, I know
yeah,
some
yeah.
people who are like looking at the movie Rubber, some people don't like that movie with the tire that's killing people. It's like, this is stupid. This makes no sense. But look at it within the context of the film, and the sense is there. Didn't you see the opening where it's just really bizarre? You know
Nope,
what
no
you're
fucking
getting.
reason, yeah.
No fucking reason. Context will set it, and that's why. Setting tone right away is important. Movies that have that jarring tone usually don't work. you can't switch gears. I need to know what world I'm getting into right from the beginning. Monty Python and Holy Grail. I mean, it's just like they just set up this lunacy, and it's like this is going to be bonkers, and it is, and it works. They made it work.
Yeah.
You know? And it could be for any genre. Just create something where you establish rules and don't break them, but definitely flaunt them. Definitely, you can exaggerate them, but don't break those rules in order to make the story work. Dark Knight works because the Dark Knight is like, we're going to make superhero, like Batman, we're going to make Batman seem real. So and they worked really hard on that. And I left the theater shaking from it because I was like, they finally got Batman right. You know? Thank you, Chris Nolan. You know?
And some of the stuff Christopher Nolan did in that movie was pushing the limits of that character too, which was also something we hadn't really seen quite to the extent that he took it, which I thought was really cool too. Yeah,
I remember when Batman Begins came out, one critic said Batman grows up. And I was like, it's about time. Unfortunately, DC hasn't done anything decent since, really, but you know. But I don't care what movie it is, just and I never make comparisons to other movies when I'm watching something unless it's a ripoff. But if I'm watching a film, like, I grade it within the scope of the film itself. So I remember buddy of mine was saying, you give too many movies 5 stars or 4 stars, and I'm like, no, I don't. I said, because I'm looking at them from with, you know, they're graded on their own merit. It's not like I'm making comparisons.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, so like Blood Car is insane, but it's awesomely insane because the whole movie is insane.
Oh, I got to thank you for, you know, letting me borrow that years ago, Bill. That movie is so awesome. And we need to do a show on Blood Car
because
people haven't seen, not enough people have seen that movie.
That movie's friggin' phenomenal.
Yeah.
Now you need to see Velocipastor. That's what you need to watch, man.
I saw that. That'll be a different conversation. Oh boy.
Well, I just saw Ed Wood's The Bride of the Monster, and I was so embarrassed for everybody who was in the picture, especially Bela Lugosi and Tor Johnson, and I was so embarrassed for Ed Wood. Sometimes I couldn't even look at the screen directly. I was embarrassed watching it. It wasn't fun like Plan 9, which is so stupid, it's hilarious. This movie was just like,
ooh.
Oh my God, that's a whole nother show. We should do an Ed Wood show. Holy
yeah,
shit.
Why don't we, yeah, that'll be next.
Now we got to watch a bunch of shitty movies.
But anyway, Bill.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I digress.
No, it's okay. But some of the other stuff, like just looking at Caligari as kind of a... What did the horror films that came after pull from it? You know, there's notions of kind of the double, in the fact that Caligari is this person, but he's also another person. But you also have the fact that Cesare, the somnambulist, he is ostensibly out there doing stuff. But oh, guess what? There's a fake Cesare in the box while the real Cesare is out doing stuff. And I like that trick because I'd forgotten about that trick in the movie. That kind of sleight of hand where the people are looking in through the window of Caligari's trailer on the fairgrounds. And oh, he's sleeping next to Cesare, who's in the coffin sleeping, obviously. And, I was like, so when they take the box out and they pull out this just like mannequin, it's kind of funny, but I'm like,
yeah,
that's clever because you see that so often used in movies as well. Even the psychic angle of things, because the part of the shtick of Caligari is that, well, Cesare, he's a somnambulist, but he can also predict, he's seen the past and can predict the future.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, how many movies have we seen that sort of where a major plot point hinges around like a psychic, like The Changeling or Don't Look Now or something like that.
Right. Exactly.
You know, that's a huge trope in the horror genre.
Oh, absolutely. And if you look at German horror movies in general from that time period, starting with The Student of Prague in 1913, Cabinet of Dr. Caligari in 1920. Now, Student of Prague is great if you want to get like a real good historical feel for Prague way back when. It's really wonderful. But the cabinet of Dr. Caligari is like, no, we're going to create this wild world. And you see part of that come through in other German films, like The Golem, which didn't work. That movie is absolutely hideous, but you could see what they take from the cabinet of Dr. Caligari. But there was also Destiny in 1921, The Haunted Castle in 1921. All of these I've seen. Even The Mechanical Man from Italy, but going up to, my gosh, we talked about Nosferatu, Hands of Warlock, Waxworks, and definitely Faust, but I'm wondering how much influence because the cabinet of Dr. Caligari had on Metropolis, which is really a phenomenal film and is horrific in its own special way. The science fiction that's really ahead of its time in many ways from 1927. What did they get? What did they take from the cabinet of Dr. Caligari? And I think they learned like we could do really amazing things, I think the cabinet of Dr. Caligari just broke a mold in a way and just said, hey, you don't just have to take a straight shot of something, and it doesn't have to look, it doesn't have to be realistic based or anything like that. You can have fun with this and make it work for your story. And I just think that, it just really helped open up film for so many other people. The sad part is 75% of all the silent films made are lost. And that's really horrific. And right in New Jersey, Fort Lee, that was the Hollywood of the East Coast after the fire burned through Fox Studios and all of that. They were like, we got to go someplace else. And they all went to Hollywood. And who knows what we're missing? So it's for me, unless there's still somewhere, I'm not a silent era historian, so I can't really do the checks and balances of what, the cabinet of Dr. Caligari learned from, because film was being made as early as 1896, I believe, was that first little horror film. It's like, well, film, it's like 3 minutes long. But it's cool to watch. They do a lot of crazy special effects in it, which is really fun. And it's like, damn. But it was still in its infancy, and I think they did a wonderful job for only $18,000 at the time. I wish I could make a feature film for $18,000. To get the sets, the actors, pay the writers, get the cast, get the crew together, and make it all work. But I think it was extremely influential.
Bill, to go back to Metropolis briefly, I watched that back when I first got my Netflix DVD subscription, and the version I watched had a bunch of stuff missing because they thought it was lost to time. So maybe there's a slight element of hope here, because I know a couple years later they came out with a version. Hey, someone had found some of this missing footage, and they'd reinserted it into the film, and they remastered the whole thing. So it was like the version I watched was like these long passages of like descript there were like these description intertitles saying this is what would be going on if we had the footage, basically. And I think there is some hope, but I know a lot of that stuff, it is unfortunate that it's been lost. But I like Caligari, I think something like Metropolis, you look at it and you can still be knocked back by it today, because
Oh, yeah.
whereas Caligari was a much more intimate kind of story and a much more intimate kind of world, Metropolis was just freaking sprawling as a film.
No, it was.
Conceptually, and
It was like an epic Hollywood movie. It really was, in so many ways. Metropolis was, and this is intimate, and they use a lot of, medium shots. They use close-ups, but it's pretty much like you're a bystander. You're one of the people hovering around trying to figure out what's going on while, these murders happen and everything else. So I like it. They did keep it close and tight, and well, they were filming on a stage, but it was great because like the whole time I'm watching, I was like, man, this would be a great theater thing to watch. Just be it'd be really cool, and that's why it always reminded me of Dogville and such, or even. I'm wondering how much the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari influenced like David Mamet in regards to keeping things tight and close and personal and intimate and, you know, blowing people's minds by keeping it tight.
Yeah, I mean, instead of like the creative sets, Mamet kind of blows your mind with the dialogue, which cuts psychologically, you know. So yeah, so I think that's fantastic. And Bill, can I bring up one scene that really
Go right
worked for
ahead.
me? And I think it's a bit iconic, is when Césaire is stalking Jane, the female protagonist in the film. He's seen coming out of shadow, kind of in this really iconic way. He's like kind of scale, like has his hands to the wall of this apartment building, and he sneaks inside through a window. And just the stiffness and the rigidity of his movements as he approaches Jane's bed, it is simply, I was just like totally transfixed by that physical performance. Because you can obviously tell, you know what? Not a single floorboard is creaking in there, because he's moving like a cat towards this bed, you know? And I really love that. And the point where he attacks her, you think, oh, she's going to die, but she doesn't. He does, for whatever reason, he does not kill her. Instead, he takes her, you know, out of the apartment building, in that iconic scene where he's walking on the rooftops. And then he just kind of drops her and he runs away. And I just kind of really, that scene was very effective to me, because I was like, you know, this, I can tell John Carpenter was like, okay, this is how I'm going to have maybe Michael Myers move in Halloween. But to me, it was more effective in Caligari, but that's my own personal thing. I just think, you know, like you were saying, Bill, Conrad Veidt was just such a good performer, and he often did that Johnny Depp thing where he was like under tons of makeup. You know, if you look up the DVD cover for The Hands of Warlock, you can't even recognize him on the cover of that thing, because he's like in all this putty makeup. But he was so good at that, you know.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And you know, just thinking about, you know, the way that like you said, like how he looked and that scene, you know, him sneaking around. That also reminds me of the real, it's and it's the best scene in the film, 1957's The Vampire, where the vampire's stalking a woman on the streets. It's reminiscent of that, and it's like, ooh. It's just really,
Nice.
it has a real frightening feel to it. You know what I was just wondering, and I don't want, I'm still staying on topic, but
Sure,
I'm
sure.
wondering how much of this art within the film, the backgrounds, the sets, where nothing matches, nothing is right, everything is skewed, how that influenced Dr. Seuss and his art.
I could see,
Mr.
yeah, you know.
Zeisel.
No, I could see that, Bill, definitely. Or it kind of brings up that thing of, well, does it have to make sense? You know, as long as there's kind of a vision or a consistency to the nonsense, you know, does it have to make sense in a conventional way?
You know, yes, I agree with you. And one of the things that we didn't talk about the filmmaking that they did that was really intriguing was sometimes they would go from those medium shots to close up, and the background would change. And I don't mean change in regard to the set, but they would sometimes like they would blacken out, like keep the background black. So you could just really focus on the face of the actor and how they were reacting, or what, you know, for whatever they were doing. And there's a whole vampire-like element to how Césaire goes and, you know, into the woman's bedroom and stuff like
Oh,
that.
yeah, absolutely.
It's
Very,
like
very Lugosi, yeah.
totally, and it's very Bram, you know, Bram Stoker must have influenced them in some way. And it's just great to see, like, not people ripping off other people, but being influenced. Like, how can we do it different or better? Because Hollywood, not Hollywood, but horror in general, always gets crushed by tropes. And like, I forgot what it was the other day. I had something on, and it started off with a shower scene in a horror film. And I'm like, fuck this. That was the first, I didn't have to see anything else. I'm like, fuck this. And my housemate Cheryl's like, what's wrong? And I said, well, this is a shower scene. They have to start with the shower scene. You hear the music. It's like, come on. And I said, I give every horror movie, three tropes. Like, if I see three tropes within the first 5 minutes, I'm out. And I forgot what the movie was. I was out. It was like this. They just did two other stupid things. So it's great to be influenced, but use it to your advantage. How can you use it and say things in a different way? You know, the old saying is there's nothing ever really new, but I don't necessarily believe that because people are coming up with something all the time that can totally change music, cinema, art, and everything else. You know, I just watched The Matrix the other night for the first time in a while. That movie was 1999 that came out, and I saw it. Blew my mind, blew a lot of people's minds. It changed action movies, it changed science fiction in many ways, and you could see it aging a little bit in certain spots, but still, that movie was just so influential about, all right, how can we film this? How can we make it look better or different or wild or crazy? And can we take the audience someplace else with it? And we're going to continue to see that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think the thing you were thinking of, Bill, was like there's only like two or three stories that
Six
mankind.
plots or something like that.
Yeah, but it's all in the way that they're told. So it's like, you know, if there's a good if someone has a vision and is able to tell that old story in a new way, it's going to be fantastic, you know.
Yeah, there's seven basic plots.
Yeah.
And that's just crazy.
It's sort of like the alphabet, 26 letters, yet we're able to. There's how many million books, you know? Yeah.
Yep, Autocrit says it's overcoming the monster, rags to riches, the quest, voyage and return, rebirth, comedy or tragedy. But within that, the stories are established by the other elements that I remember used to teach was, you know, it could either be about human versus human versus self, human versus robot, human versus alien, you know, human versus environment. And that's why I love the movie Alien, because it covers all of those, you
Oh, yeah.
know, and which is really cool. And the thing is, when, you know, people write, you know, they're not necessarily thinking of this consciously, but it's like, you know, really, what, you know, but if you want to go deep like that, the cool thing is you can, and you can, you know, incorporate whatever you want to make it work. And in this movie, they make it work. We're looking at some psychological maelstrom, you know, the way the movie's set up. And I just really loved it. It was really enjoyable. It's cool to watch, a lot of fun.
Yeah, I'm with you, Bill. I was really glad this movie turned 100, so we had an excuse to do this show because it gave me a chance to rewatch it and be like, oh man, I really do on a second viewing, I get it more and I appreciate it a lot more than I did when I first saw it. So yeah, I actually just placed an order for the Blu-ray today. So I'm like, yeah,
Nice.
I'm down with the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. So maybe Bill, before you go get some food, or maybe I can spoon feed you some food.
Ooh, baby.
Do you got some scream outs tonight to go with the show and dance?
That I do, and these are people that we have never screamed out to before, Jenny.
Oh.
So what I'm going to do is tell you their name, give you their Twitter handle, and tell you a little their repeat their blurb and go on.
Sure.
Almost Normal Productions, and that's ANP Films on Twitter. Almost Normal Productions is a film production company driven by Elisabetta Vidovic. And this is all about women in film. Severed Silence is something that you're doing. You're out of LA. Go to almostnormalproductions.com for more very cool stuff. Tina likes horror. Yes, she does. She enjoys horror movies, books, cemeteries, Halloween, paranormal, skulls. She's a wife and mother, and she says hello to the horror family, which is great. And she posts occasional polls, which she does, and they're very cool ones too. Alexandria Daniels, who's that? That is Film N with an N, Vinyl. Blogger, freelance writer for hire, cinephile, loves horror, indie art house, and animation. And follow her on alexandria-daniels.com. Nerds Horror. So who are the nerds horror? They are the actual horror nerds. Hello, fellow nerds. Welcome to Horror Nerds, your one stop to all things creepy. We discuss horror items from creepy artifacts to scary stories. So that's really cool. They're out of Florida. Anzai, Anzai, cyberpunk horror author of the episodic series Strange Tales from the City of Dust, now on Kindle, creator of the Necropolis series on Medium. Married, just in case you wanted to know. Where they live, the City of Dust. You can find more at VAZANZAI, Vazani.com. And my housemate just ran out of the room to get our dinner that I was going to pay for. I'm going to kill her. Sorry. I'm just
Cheryl,
like.
Cheryl, come back.
She bolted. I'm going to kill her. Flixology 101. Watch, drink, enjoy. That sounds great. Doing my best to save the world. One clip, one sip at a time. Underappreciated, lousy screenwriter. Aren't we all? And founder of Flixology101.com out of Frederick, Maryland. And go to Flixology with an X, 101.com. Go to the website. Joshua Frantic, co-founder and rabble rouser at Source Point Press. I bring books and comics to life. Art director, production manager, illustrator, designer, author, and sometimes actor. You can find out more about Joshua Werner on imdb.com. And T. Carter, who's that? That's the horror underscore disciple. I have two awesome daughters, and I said, oh my God, I sounded like friggin' Northern New Jersey. I'm taking a sip of friggin' coffee.
Daughters, Bill.
Fuck you, Johnny Num. I have two awesome daughters, an amazing wife, and I've had a passion for horror movies ever since I was a kid out of Bowling Green, Kentucky. G, who's G? That's Cyber Sphinx, circumspect Lone Ranger, drafter of unfinished novels, secessional Dr. G, gothic studies, dystopias, online since 1992, she, her, all genders are welcome here, out of the beautiful city, my favorite city, Vancouver, British Columbia. And also you could find Cyber Sphinx on Instagram.com. Finally, Dark Reflections UK Limited, Dark Reflections with a Z. Back from the Ashes, retailer of gothic alternative merchandise, proudly stocking custom items from M's Amiguri. Not Caligari, Amiguri.
Ah, nice.
So that's me, Johnny. I believe you have a soul or two.
I got a couple. At the request of our constant listener, DM Elms, who you can find at Virago Ergo Sum on Twitter. I think I got that right.
Mm-hmm.
She recommended the wonderful J.J. James, and you can find him at JJJames_games on Twitter. He is the game host for Last Call Trivia in Portland, Oregon, and Willamette Valley.
Mm-hmm.
You can his website is lastcalltrivia.com, and you can find him on Facebook at JJJames.games. He's a good guy, always has some good observations when we interact on Twitter. And Old Man Mike at OMM Music with a CK, IDM, lo-fi, guitar, vocal, electro, industrial, ambient. Listen to my new album, Super Void. You can find his music at Old Man Mike Innit, INNIT.bandcamp.com. Please check out Bandcamp. It's just a great site to support your artist more directly than if you'd order their stuff off Amazon. And his stuff, all the stuff he listed, is very close to my own musical taste, so I'm looking forward to checking it out.
Awesome.
And finally, Sue, letter Z, letter Q, at Fountain Clown, emergency nurse, It and Lost fan, vegan, writer, film lover, fun lover, tattoo fan, reader, blogger, seeker. You can find her at theresalwaysacat.com. She left a nice comment on my recent review of The Lodge, and actually it turned into a spiral down our mutual love for It Chapter 2, which was very nice to have recently. So check her out and check out her website. Yeah.
So awesome.
Those are the ones I got, Bill.
Awesome souls. Then I'm going to tell everybody where they could find me, and you're going to end the damn show. How about that?
Okay.
You can find me at Crash Palace on Twitter for all things horror, and go to CrashPalaceProductions.com for links to this show and wonderful articles, including those by our own Johnny Num. And you can also follow me at Noir Kink on Twitter, and that's to my erotic crime thriller book writing insanity. Johnny,
It's good stuff.
good stuff.
You can find me on Twitter and Letterboxd at Johnny Numb. There are no H's in those Johnnies. If you're astute, you can also find me on Facebook under my actual name. You can find my writing at Crash Ballast Productions because Billy's a nice guy. And you can also find my writing at 1428elm.com because Susan Layton, aka Susan on the Ledge, is just awesome, and I'm happy to be writing for her. So, yeah.
Yeah, can't wait. Hopefully when this outbreak is broken, it'll be cool if we can get a chance to see her out here.
Yeah, I told her not to be a stranger if she comes up even remotely close, so.
Well, I sold her on banners. I know she wants a sip, so the only way to get it, sister, is to get out of here.
And any sane person should want a sip of banners. Man, I want a sip of banners every time I look at their Facebook posts. I'm like, oh, I want this deliciousness.
Their new grapefruit cider with hops is insane.
I believe it. Everything they put out is good, man.
Yeah, and a strawberry lemonade, that's like, it's great, man.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to
Fantastic.
try.
It's just all, it's all yummy. It's all yummy in the tummy, Johnny.
Yeah, maybe if they'd had banters during the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, things would have turned out differently for the characters. I don't know.
The Cabinet of Dr. Cider. I'm sorry. Anyway, on that note.
Right, Bill, sounds good. I'm just going to sort of stalk along a wall very ominously,
You do that, and I'm going to measure every window and see how crooked they all are.
Make sure they're shaped like daggers. Yeah.
Yeah, shaped like daggers and other weird Dr. Seuss looking things. Craziness. Craziness. I loved it.
One somnambulist, two somnambulist, three somnambulist. I don't know what rhymes with that. Yeah.
Four. But no, seriously, watch this. It's the it's considered to be the first horror movie, even though that's necessarily not necessarily true. Maybe the first feature, not the, even the first feature. No, it isn't because it's Student of Prague. But anyway, it's fantastic. It has a legacy, and it's worthwhile, and it's definitely worth watching. It's really worth listening to, right?
Absolutely, Bill. Absolutely. I hear it calling me now. Yeah.
Forget it. I'm not gonna do any. I was gonna do something stupid. I'm not. Good night, Johnny.
Night, Billy.